themselves on numerous occasions. Would the outcomes for our sons have been different? Might they have received different care and lived? Had they not been black? Johnson said she hopes the new study gives people greater understanding of all that's lost when black people die prematurely. When we lose these lives long, when we lose that potential, that has an impact on all of the society, she said. And in the black community, our pain is real and deep and profound, and it deserves attention and validation, Johnson said. It often feels like people just pass it over, telling you to stop complaining. But the expectation can't be that we just endure these things and bounce back. Telly Scott Moore said she struggles with the death of her 16-year-old son, Timothy, an athlete who hoped to attend Boston College and study sports medicine. He died of sudden cardiac arrest in 2011, a rare condition that kills about 100 young athletes a year. Research shows that an underlying heart condition that can lead to sudden cardiac death, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, often goes unrecognized in black patients. Scott Moore still wonders if she should have recognized warning signs. She also has blamed herself for failing to protect her two younger sons who found Timothy's body after he collapsed. At times, Scott Moore said she wanted to give up. Instead, she said the family created a foundation to promote education and health screenings to prevent such deaths. She hears from families all over the world, and supporting them has helped heal her pain. She said, "My grief comes back in waves. It comes back when I least expect it." Of Baltimore County, Maryland, she said, "Life goes on, but it's a pain that never goes away."
The occupation jails.
Today we visited Remand prison. We left the house at 3 o'clock. The ICRC bus picked us up at 4. Then the ICRC officers checked and gave us permits. They coordinated our visit and gave us some instructions about behaviors and meals to avoid a security search. The children rejoice that they're going to see their father for the first time. For example, my little son Mohannad has never seen his father. Mohannad does not even know him. We had been promised that all the children will meet their father. Unfortunately, Mohannad was allowed to meet his dad, but his brother wasn't. The little child started crying. We begged them to let him go with his brother, but they turned a cold shoulder.
I love my dad. I miss him so much. I asked them for an hour to enter, but the Israelis refused. I was looking forward to hugging him.
The ICRC staff did their best to help us by all means. They relieved my fears of the visit. Honestly speaking, I was afraid and did not want to go. I refused the visit, but later when I met Abu Said, who came with the ICRC officers, I became quiet and calm. I thought that whatever happened in the prison would be safe with the ICRC officers.
Uh,
ICRC is coordinating with Palestinian and Israeli authorities in order to allow Gazan detainees to receive visits from their families. During family visits, ICRC staff is always present at Erez checkpoint in order to facilitate the crossing.
The story begins here. A Palestinian family rejoiced in releasing his son from the Israeli occupation jails after 23 years of imprisonment.
I was very optimistic about being included in the first list of prisoners to be released. I spent 23 years in the prison and had to spend another 2 years of the sentence. I was not surprised so much by the release, but I was absolutely excited about it. But I wish the list had included some brothers of mine in the prison who were sentenced to life imprisonments rather than releasing me. Anyway, it was my destiny to be free, thanks Allah. When they brought us from the prison to Gaza and we found such a reception at Erez Crossing, we were very proud of our people, relatives, and the homeland. I met my beloved sons, family, relatives, and people.
I was tortured in isolated underground cells because I did not confess anything. In the beginning of my imprisonment, I refused to speak. Then I discovered I was pregnant. I announced a hunger strike, and my announcement way was different from the way now made by the prisoners.
Umm Mahmoud al-Zaq, a released prisoner, has suffered a lot from imprisonment. She withstood against torture apparatus. She was a good example in standing against the enemy and in belonging to home.
It was not just to say I announced hunger strike. I refused to have meals from the Israeli canteen, and I used to tell them, I do not have an appetite. This statement was my slogan, which confused the officers. It would have been easier for them if I simply said I was hunger striking.
With silently crying eyes seeking to meet their beloved imprisoned son, and raising victory signs in reference to keep demonstration, as long as their sons are imprisoned in the Israeli jails, prisoners' families marched to the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC office in Gaza on Mondays, to send their message to the world. Abu Sharif, a father of a prisoner in Israeli jail, talks about prisoners' situation, suffering of prisoners' families, and their weekly demonstration.
The Monday demonstration is sacred. We have to demonstrate in solidarity with the prisoners. We call for prisoners' freedom and good treatment instead of maltreating them inside the Israeli jails.
The main players of the international community, they support Israel by a way or another, and they lived a long time ago in conspiracy of silence, which gives the Israel the green light to violate and to increase their violations against the Palestinians.
In the journey for covering another suffering, we met Umm Nidal, a mother of two long-term prisoners, aged and burdened with life bitterness. A journey of 1,000 miles begins here.
Dia was jailed at the age of 16 on October the 10th in 1992. Next month, Dia will be 22 years old. He executed a heroic resistance operation for the sake of his people and cause. This is why the Israelis arrested him. Mohammed, who is 22 years old, has been detained since he was 11. He was 11 when his brother was arrested. He's been in prison for 11 years. We used to visit him fortnightly. To us, the visit day was like a festival or a pilgrimage, actually as if we're going to visit the Prophet or the Kaaba. The night before the visit, we felt that we were really going to the Kaaba. They were our sons in the jail. It was absolute rejoice. We were not able to sleep the night before the visit. We stayed up all night waiting for the visiting time next day. But since the impose of the Shali'a law, Gaza families have been prohibited from visiting their sons in prison.
Mohammed Nashabat, a recently released prisoner, is still receiving his friends and relatives, telling them about the pains of the prison.
Interrogation was miserable. It was unbelievable. First of all, the investigation was psychiatric torture. I was tied by the hands and legs, and my head covered with a foul-smelling bag, my clothes torn and my body partially naked. The jailers used to force me to stay in this manner for 3 or 4 hours. Then they forced me to keep standing for 4 to 10 hours in miserable humiliation, sleepless, without looking at what was going on around me. I was not allowed to sleep or to sit down. When I surrendered to sleep, I was suddenly beaten. I suffered from this interrogative method for 28 days. International law, including the Fourth Geneva Convention, is applicable in occupied territories like Palestine, including the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and Jerusalem. According to the convention, the law of war is applicable in these territories. So anyone arrested by a military occupation in occupied territories is called a civilian prisoner, not a prisoner of war. This is the general basis.
حمل ثقيل يعني هذا متجوز وعنده أسرة وسوين ثنتين وبيت ملوش.
It is really a big burden. He is married and has a family and two wives. He does not have a house. They have lived in a room in my house since he was arrested. They suffer a lot. Even his first wife is not allowed to visit him in the prison. The absence of the father makes a big problem. In our Arab culture, the father, with the mother's assistance, is the only one who can raise his children well. So they suffer from his absence psychologically and socially.
Men's eyes do not tear, but refuse tyranny. The son and mother of the prisoner are preoccupied with unforgettable memories.
Sharif used to come here in the kitchen every Friday on his way to the mosque close to our place.
In the first week, I was not able to sleep or relax. I was tied by the hands and legs to a middle chair, bowing forward sometimes and backward with the hands tied to the legs from the back other times. I estimated these stays lasted from 8 to 10 hours each day. I was even prohibited from praying on the chair. During this week, I refused to talk about anything related to the occupied territories. I was tortured physically and psychologically.
As long as imprisonment isolates a human from a normal life, it has severe effects on his or her psychology and mentality. This means a human lacks a normal life and communication with people and turns him or her to living an abnormal life. Sometimes solitary confinement aims to deprive a human of his or her natural psychology and intellectuality. Imprisonment forces a human to live an abnormal life full of difficulties, isolated from normality, and deprived of a family and loved ones.
The prisoners who have been exiled from their own cities and families soon after being released participate in the demonstration of prisoners' families, calling for stopping oppressing sentences against the exiled and prisoners.
Exiling the Palestinians, who are the original population of the land, is a well-known Israeli policy and has been practiced by the occupation from 1948 until now. Its main goal is to replace the Palestinians with settlements and settlers in the West Bank. For this reason, the Israelis imposed wave of exile actions like the Marj al-Zohar exile, the exile of the Nativity Church, and those who were already exiled to prison. There was an occupation policy to get rid of the land's original population. The deported lost his heritage, his roots, his past, his life, his relationships, all his memories, his whole experience, his personality.
Israel used to transfer the Palestinians who are accused by Israel that they are dangerous and they have secret files against them as one of the extreme violations of the international law. The international law prevents the occupation and doesn't give the occupation the right to deport any Palestinian from his or her land. But they used this kind of violations or such decisions since long time ago against many Palestinians. Because Israel doesn't admit or recognize the international law.
بعد سبع سنين شفت ابني شوف ايش كانت حالتي
يعني I saw my son after 7 years. You can imagine how I was waiting for his release. I could not know whether I was crying or confused. Looking at my watch for a while, laughing and crying for another, I was not able to utter a single word. Finally, when I saw Muhammad, I could not control my behavior. I started pulling him, and an Israeli soldier forcibly kept my son away. The soldier threatened me that if Muhammad and I would not stop pulling each other, he would not allow us to have a photo. Indeed, I wanted to hug my son rather than to have a photo with him.
Visiting a prisoner takes 15 to 16 hours. We walk to the ICRC office at 4 o'clock. Then a lot of procedures start, taking the buses to Erez Crossing, waiting until it opens, passing the crossing to a security search, and then returning to the buses for a journey of 2 hours to arrive at the prison.
I wish I could live until the time when my son is released. I've been told he might be included in the first or second list of prisoners to be released. I pray to God to see him. Why not to see him? I can feel my wish coming true.
Prison prevented Ahmed Nashabat from bidding farewell to his mother before she had passed away. The crew accompanied Muhammad in his visit to the tomb. Yusuf is a child whose mother delivered him while she was imprisoned. Jail doors raised him in an endless flow of fear.
They deprived my baby from milk at the age of 2 months due to their claim that the Israeli milk company is closed. For me, the milk price was very expensive, so I weaned the baby off breast milk and fed him bread and yogurt. Can you imagine this? Then the baby's temperature rose high and he had a convulsion. I thought I would lose my baby. And this all was because of the occupation's carelessness. The occupation never provided health care to the baby. He had not been checked by any doctor except one time. And I doubt whether that was a real doctor or an intelligence officer pretending.
Nashabat, the released prisoner, meets one of his prison friends after being released.
Welcome. How are you doing?
I am fine. How are you?
I am glad to see you.
How are your colleagues?
They are all fine. They send their warm greetings to you and wish you all the best.
Thank God for your release.
Thank you.
ما استخدموا معنا بس فقط اللي هو العذاب النفسي ولكن كمان انه العنف العنف بالفترة اللي فاتت كان اللي هي هزة الرقبة.
They impose not only psychological torture on us but also violence. The most violent torture we feared was shaking the neck or the chest because it resulted in the brain shaking. But thanks God, we passed this experiment well, so we can bear any difficulty for the sake of our fair cause. We have chosen this way ourselves. Nobody forced us to do so. During the test of jail, interrogation happened 5 or 6 times each night. 3 to 5 intelligence officers interrogated you in their office. They always spoke to us in an obscene tone, abusing and insulting us and our relatives. They aimed to weaken our will and self-confidence as Palestinian fighters.
كثير من الأحيان وأنت قاعد في الاعتقال أو في أي مكان آخر أنت بتعيد الشيوط مرة أخرى قدام عينيك.
A prisoner always flashes back to the actions imposed on him in prison. These memories may also stimulate the ear, eye, and skin if the memories include torture. So the prisoner's mind becomes like a piece of sponge that absorbs events and actions in the jail from the beginning to the end. So the effects of imprisonment remain inside a human his whole life. The Israeli violations towards the prisoners escalate every day. This can be noticed from the use of solitary confinement and torture, including some policies whose effects are not apparent, but leave an impact on all the prisoners. Israeli exile has many forms: interior, exterior, group, and individual. Individual exile is exiling a person from prison to a place out of his homeland or to the Gaza Strip. A good example is the case of the Nativity Church. Of 39 fighters, 26 were exiled to the Gaza Strip and 13 to European countries. So the forms and colors of exile policy the Israeli occupation applies are various.
They use the
78 item of the 4 Geneva Conventions, and they analyze it according to their benefits, the Israel security benefit, because one of the items of the conventions gives the occupation the right to impose any Palestinian to stay in his the same area, but not to transfer him from his own area to another geographical area, like what happened with these two in this case.
To me, the exiled person is similar to someone made naked in front of others. From this perspective, we found its effects dangerous to let such a person live with his memories far away. Even phone calls with his relatives could not compensate for his deprivation of his real environment, which he now misses.
The journey of suffering keeps on going, beginning from the ICRC office and ending in the Erez crossing, the line separating the Gaza Strip and the Israeli occupation. After this journey of challenge and humiliation ends, the relatives of the released prisoners can hardly meet their sons for a few minutes, a period that does not even get the mother's tears of this affecting meeting dried.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime's five-day bombing campaign destroyed 93 housing units in Gaza, partially damaged 1,820 and rendered 128 others uninhabitable. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, near the debris of their home in the northern Gaza Strip, the Naphan extended family spent their first night of displacement sleeping on the ground in the open after an Israeli regime airstrike flattened their four-story building. The 50 members of the family, all civilians, including five people with physical and mental health problems, lived in eight separate apartments. The airstrike was carried out on the last day of the Zionist regime's five-day attack on the Gaza Strip, in a campaign it launched on May 9th, before the ceasefire took effect. The attack left at least 33 Palestinians killed, including six children and three women. My home is adjacent to my family's home. I decided to stay with them when the attack started because I thought it was safer than mine. Umm Muhammad, the eldest sister in the family, told the Middle East Eye, adding, "We suddenly saw my brother running towards us and shouting, 'Get out of the house, it will be targeted.' We told him, 'You are talking about our home, that's our only shelter. Where will we go?' He said, 'We only have 5 minutes. Get out now.'" According to eyewitnesses, an Israeli regime intelligence officer called one of the family's neighbors and asked him to inform the family that the house would be targeted. Omohamad said, the neighbor told him that the building housed people with disabilities and that it would be impossible to get them out of the house in only 5 minutes. The officer said it was not his business and that they would target the house anyway. Omohamad, whose home was also damaged in the strike, said that the family would stay displaced until a solution is found because none of their relatives' houses could contain their large number. We are 50 individuals. People would welcome us for 1 or 2 days, but no one would have the capacity to keep us any longer, she said. On the ground near Omohamad sat her younger sister, Ayat, who suffers from both physical disabilities and mental health problems. When asked about her age, the 23-year-old woman told MEE that she was 3 years old. However, she was well aware of what happened last night. She said, suddenly the house was destroyed. We forgot the medicine inside. We forgot the wheelchairs inside. We were afraid. We stayed on the street and we slept here. We want another house that has medicine and wheelchairs inside. During the 5 days of attack, the Zionist regime completely destroyed at least 93 housing units and rendered 128 others uninhabitable. Another 1,820 housing units were damaged, according to the Gaza Ministry of Public Works and Housing. In another neighborhood, in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza Strip, Samir Taha has already built a tent beside his destroyed home. Recently, two Israeli regime F-16s flattened the building's 7 apartments and penetrated the ground. Taha, whose previous home was also destroyed by an Israeli regime airstrike in 2014, waited 2 years before the Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism, GRM, helped him and his married children build this home. On the ruins of his new home, Taha now stood tearful. During the 2014 offensive in Gaza, they bombed another house belonging to us. We remained displaced for 2 years before the reconstruction mechanism could build us a home, the 62-year-old man told MEE. He continued, I built a tent near my home and I stayed in for 2 years. I refused to take shelter in schools or to rent a house following the attack. This time, I will do the same. It wasn't enough that they destroyed the building, but the missiles also penetrated the ground. This reflects the terror they want to inflict. The home of Taha's nephews next to his house was also targeted by airstrikes. According to his nephew, Muhammad Taha, the two buildings housed at least 42 people. The 33-year-old man said, I grew up in this house. I lived here since I was 7 years old, and I got married in the same house. We left the house barefoot. We did not have any time to take our belongings with us, not even our money. We are 3 brothers living here. Each family consists of 7 individuals. Muhammad Taha said, he would build a tent near his home and stay there with his family until their home is rebuilt. He added, this tent would neither protect us from the cold nor the heat of the summer, not even from stray dogs. But what else can we do? Less than 24 hours after the Taha family homes were targeted, another one belonging to the Hassanat family was hit. Before the airstrike was carried out, the homeowner, Faraj Hassanat, was in the adjacent graveyard. An Israeli intelligence officer called me and asked me to go back home. He told me, I can see that you are in the graveyard. I asked him why he wanted me to return home. He told me, I want to bomb your house. Hassanat 38 told MEE. He said, I told him, why would you bomb my house? I am a normal citizen working in farmlands. I have no connections with any factions. He said, go back to your house and get your family out of it. The intelligence officer then asked Hassanat to warn his neighbors because he wanted to bomb an entire square. I told him, you said you would bomb my home. What do you now mean you want to bomb an entire square? He answered, okay, then I want to bomb your house, your brother's house, and your other brother's house, he said. I raised my hand, saying, God is sufficient for us. He told me, do not raise your hands. I looked up towards the sky and I saw a drone. I told him, you are recording me? He said, yes, I can see you. A few minutes later, the houses of Hassanat and his brothers turned into piles of rubble. The thing is not about my house only. Many of the neighbors' homes have now become uninhabitable. We all have become displaced. Prior to the Zionist regime's most recent military attack on Gaza, more than 90,000 housing units were partially or completely destroyed in Israeli regime offensive since 2008.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining a very important and pertinent question, a question that a lot of people ask and a lot of people are eager to know the answer to. That question is about the characteristics of the God-wary and the pious, the muttaqin. So the question we're asking is, what are the characteristics of the God-wary? You know, this is a topic that has been touched upon in the Holy Quran in many places. In one verse of the Holy Quran, God narrates and mentions the characteristics of the God-wary in the following way. God-wariness is not to turn your faces to the east or the west. Rather, God-wariness is personified by those who have faith in Allah and the last day, the angels, the book, and the prophets, and those who give their wealth for the love of Him to the needy, the traveler, and the beggar, and for the freeing of the slaves, and maintain the prayer, and give the zakat, and those who fulfill their covenants when they pledge themselves, and those who are patient in stress and distress and in the heat of battle, they are the ones who are true to their covenant. It is they who are the God-wary. Also, in another beautiful verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following. Indeed, the God-wary will be amid gardens and springs, receiving what their Lord has given them. For they had been virtuous aforetime. They used to sleep a little during the night, and at dawns they would plead for forgiveness, and there was a share in their wealth for the beggar and the deprived. In this connection, it's been narrated in the Nahjul Balagha that a companion of the Commander of the Faithful, whose name was Hammam and was a devoted worshipper, had said to him, O Commander of the Faithful, describe to me the God-weary in such a way as though I was to see them. So he, alayhi salam, praised Allah and extolled him and praised the Prophet and then said, The God-weary in this world are the people of virtue. Their speech is to the point. Their dress is moderate and their gait is humble. They keep their eyes closed to what Allah has made unlawful for them. And they put their ears to that knowledge which is beneficial to them. They remain in times of trials as they had been in times of comfort. If there had not been fixed periods of life ordained for each, their spirits would not have remained in their bodies even for the twinkling of an eye, because of their eagerness for the reward and fear of chastisement. The sign of any one of them is that you will see that he has strength in religion, prudence along with leniency, faith with conviction, eagerness in seeking knowledge with forbearance, moderation in wealth, devotion in worship, gracefulness in neediness, endurance in hardship, desire for the lawful, pleasure in guidance, and hatred of greed. He performs virtuous deeds, but still feels afraid. In the evening, he is anxious to offer thanks to Allah. In the morning, his anxiety is to remember Allah. He passes the night in fear and rises in mourning in joy. Fearless night is passed in forgetfulness and joy over the favor and mercy received by him. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the characteristics and features of the pious and God-weary. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
A new research has found that U.S. police sweeps of homeless encampments across the country have the potential to increase deaths among people who are unhoused by 25%. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out wrote in this regard, new research published by the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, finds that U.S. police sweeps of homeless encampments have the potential to increase deaths among people who are unhoused by 25% by 2028. On a single night in 2022, more than 500,000 people in the U.S. were unhoused. The research found with black people and indigenous people experiencing homelessness at disproportionate rates, partially as a result of exorbitant housing prices and the U.S.'s often discriminatory housing market, the number of people experiencing unsheltered homelessness increased by 3% between 2020 and 2022. Jurisdictions have responded to this epidemic, brought on in large part by corporate greed and the real estate lobby, by instituting camping bans, city ordinances that make it a crime for any person to shelter themselves from the elements while residing on public or private property, effectively criminalizing homelessness. The National Homelessness Law Center, NHLC, the only national organization dedicated to using the U.S. legal system to end homelessness, reports that almost every state has at least one law restricting homeless people on the books, with four states restricting camping in public statewide and more than 100 jurisdictions criminalizing homeless encampments. Punitive policies like homeless sweeps aren't just cruel and ineffective, they also actively worsen the crisis, says Eric Tars, legal director for NHLC. When homelessness is effectively criminalized, unhoused people are burdened by arrest, jail time, and criminal records, making it even more difficult for them to access housing, social services, and employment. Homeless sweeps also threaten unhoused people's health, well-being, and connections to care, compromise personal safety and civic trust, and undermine paths to housing and financial stability, according to the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council. During encampment sweeps, police often seize, damage, or destroy items needed for survival, such as tents. These sweeps and the displacement that follows are traumatizing for people who are unsheltered, often exacerbating already existing mental conditions and pushing residents into more dangerous, isolated environments. U.S. police also frequently destroy life-saving medications and medical equipment, such as the overdose protection drug naloxone, that is Narcan, effectively contributing to overdose deaths. A stigma against drug use pushes people into isolation, and that's a recipe for unwitnessed overdose, said Yola Tepper, substance use specialist at the Knight Ministry in Chicago, adding, "When we take away encampments, we take away a community that can serve as a first line of defense against a potential death when an overdose happens." In the U.S., more than 30% of people who are experiencing homelessness also have a substance use disorder. Continual involuntary displacement through homeless encampment sweeps contributes to a 15-24% increase in deaths among unhoused people who use drugs. The study explains, involuntary displacement of people experiencing homelessness may substantially increase drug-related morbidity and mortality. These findings have implications for the practice of involuntary displacement, as well as policies such as access to housing and supportive services that could mitigate these harms. Sweeps, we predict, will contribute up to 25% of deaths among this population over a 10-year period. Dr. Joshua Barocas, principal investigator of the study and infectious disease doctor and associate professor at the University of Colorado Medical Campus, told Denner Reed, adding, to put that a different way, it means our states and our cities in the U.S. are literally killing people with this. Meanwhile, U.S. News reported a new survey offers a grim picture of America's youth. Aside from fears of gun violence or homelessness, mental health remains a problem. Homelessness is a worry for young Americans, with nearly three-fourths, that is 73%, saying homelessness can happen to anyone, and nearly a third, about 32%, telling IOP pollsters that they are concerned they personally could become homeless one day. The survey offers a grim picture for an age cohort just beginning their adult lives. Aside from fears of having their lives cut short by gun violence or upended by homelessness, mental health remains a problem for American youth. The poll found nearly half, about 47% of the under 30s reported feeling down, depressed or hopeless, and 24% said they had thoughts that they would be better off dead or had thought about hurting themselves for at least several days in the previous 2 weeks. And a first ever question about loneliness resulted in similarly disparaging results. 44% said they had been bothered by loneliness for at least several days in the previous few weeks. 46% reported little interest or pleasure in doing things. And 55% reported feeling nervous, anxious, or on edge.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program that takes you on a journey through Africa. We cover wide-ranging current affairs in the continent and also highlight various aspects of the continent's rich history, culture, and civilization. In the first segment of our show today, we are focusing on the recent deadly clashes in Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland and the semi-autonomous Puntland region. There is concern that the United States plans to build a military base in Somaliland with the covert objective of balkanizing Somalia, a very strategic Horn of Africa nation. The second part of our program is focusing on reports that the U.S. trained military officers involved in several coups and coup attempts in Africa over the last 3 years. What is the U.S. pursuing in its continued destabilization of Africa?
U.S. and NATO balkanizing Somalia. Since early February, there has been heavy fighting in the northern Somali city of Las Anod between troops of Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland and local militia in northern Somalia. Somaliland declared its independence from Mogadishu in 1991. In February, officials associated with the Sul, Sanaag, and Kane, the SSC, regions in Somaliland declared they will be administered by the federal government of Somalia. This decision was rejected by Somaliland, leading to deadly clashes in an area bordering Puntland, a semi-autonomous region of Somalia. As Somaliland forces battled Somali nationalists, U.S.-led NATO officials met secessionist Somaliland President Muse Bihi Abdi. As tensions continue to rise in this region, the U.S. is moving ahead with plans to build a military base in Somaliland's Somaliland Berbera. Analysts believe this decision is in tandem with NATO's nefarious objective of Balkanizing Somalia.
Most people in Somalia have categorically rejected any attempts to fragment the country and have insisted that they back a united Somalia. A Somalia activist speaks here after a unity meeting in Nairobi last February.
Only want to send only one message that Somaliland are killing innocent people. They have been shelling for 14 days consecutive last Anod for nothing. They have been fighting for last Anod for the last 15 years, which is wrong. And we want to tell the international community that we are people of last Anod. We are unity. We are there for unity of Somalia. We are not there for a separation of Somalia.
For more on the recent clashes in last Anod, Somalia, we have contacted Jonathan Ofei and Sir, the publisher of Africa Briefing. Thanks a lot, Sir, for your time. Now, do you think the U.S.-led NATO military alliance is backing secessionists in their battle with nationalists in Somalia?
While it is true that the external actors can play, an exacerbating conflicts or pursuing their own interests in the Balkan region, the presence of these foreign military forces can sometimes also escalate tensions and fuel resentment among local populations. Additionally, the pursuit of economic and strategic interest by external actors can also sometimes, exacerbate existing conflicts or create new ones. And ultimately, the situation in Somaliland is complex, right? And there are multiple factors at play. And so while the U.S., EU, and NATO have expressed interest in establishing a military presence in the region, it is actually difficult to determine the extent to which they are contributing to the conflict. And it's also important for all external actors to respect the sovereignty of the region and they also work towards a peaceful resolution of the conflict.
In 2018, there were military tensions between the United States and China in Djibouti. In a provocative move, the Pentagon claimed that Chinese lasers injured U.S. military pilots in Djibouti. The then China's foreign ministry spokesperson refuted the allegation, saying they were in complete contradiction to the facts.
I can tell you the Chinese side, having conducted serious checks, has already clearly told the U.S. side that their so-called criticisms totally do not accord with the facts.
The United States is most likely planning to build a massive naval base in the Berbera port in Somaliland as an alternative to its military base in neighboring Djibouti, where the Chinese established a military base seen as too close for comfort for Washington.
Yep, there have been reports, yes, speculation that the U.S. is actually using the Berbera port as an alternative to its military base, its neighboring military base in Sudan. The Chinese establishment of a base in Djibouti in 2017 raised concerns in Washington about China's expanding military presence in Africa and its potential threat to U.S. interests in the region. Okay, and the U.S. has shown interest in using the port, for military purposes. With some reports, I guess that the U.S. Military has already established a presence there. But the U.S. has not officially confirmed or denied the reports, but it has acknowledged that it is closely monitoring the situation in the region. And also, while the U.S. may be using the Berbera port as an alternative to the base in Djibouti, it is important to consider that the larger geopolitical factors, you know, at play in the region, including China's influence